Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Physics and philosophy, this week on Soundings. My guests are Barry Lower of Rutgers University and David Albert of Columbia University. According to Barry Lower and David Albert, quantum mechanics invites a reconsideration of the most basic philosophical categories traditionally used to think about the world. Here is David Albert.
The 20th century has witnessed a number of astonishing discoveries about the properties of subatomic particles. It probably won't be to the point to describe the history of those discoveries in any detail here, but let me give some idea of why those discoveries have the philosophical impact or constitute the kind of philosophical curiosity that they do. We have done experiments over the past 50 years on subatomic particles, which persuade us of situations like the following. We have found electrons. Let's imagine that the property we're talking about is color, say. We have found subatomic particles on which we're able to do experiments in such a way that the outcomes of these experiments persuade us that we've seen some electrons which are, say, blue and other electrons which are green. That is, we've seen electrons which are blue, we've seen electrons which are green, and moreover, we've seen electrons in situations where the outcomes of experiments we do on them are persuasive that it is wrong to call these electrons blue ones, it's wrong to call them green ones. It's moreover wrong to say of them that they have any other color or that they have no color at all. And it's also wrong to say of them that in any straightforward sense they have both colors, like they're half blue and half green or something like that. And what's unsettling about that, of course, is that that apparently exhausts the usual set of logical alternatives that we're used to.
All right. Now, we'll come to some of the philosophical implications of all of that, David Albert, Barry Lower, in just a moment. Barry, let me ask you to move from the micro world to the macro world. Tell me about the paradox of the cat in the box. What do you two have in mind with that story?
Well, as David was just saying, in the micro world, particles, subatomic particles, can be in these very odd states where they have some kind of property. An electron is located somewheres, but it's not located in any particular place, as paradoxical and strange as that sounds. Well, the theory of that, there's a powerful and interesting theory of that called quantum mechanics. That theory predicts how the state of an electron evolves over time and also predicts what happens when electrons interact with each other and when electrons interact with macroscopic devices. And strange as it might sound, that theory predicts that when an electron in one of these odd states, which incidentally is called a superposition, that an electron in one of these odd states, when it interacts with a macroscopic measuring device, throws that measuring device into a superposition as well.
Now here we're back. Now we're coming to the cat in the box.
Yes, exactly. And Erwin Schrödinger, one of the developers of quantum mechanics in the 1920s and 30s, noticed this feature of the theory and illustrated it with this example. He said, suppose there was a system, an isolated system, which consisted of a cat which could interact with an electron in the following way. If the electron had a definite property, and I'll continue with David's illustration of color. the electron was definitely blue, uh-huh. then the cat would be killed. A horrible example, but the one Schrodinger used. If the electron was definitely red, then the cat would live and be petted, we suppose.
So we're posing a polarity here, two alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right,
mm-hmm.
fair enough.
But now the electron can be in a superposition of being blue and red.
Are you guys going to give me some science fiction here? Are we talking about what, zombies, the living dead, that kind
of
thing?
Well, it's important to, delineate which parts of this have been experimentally confirmed explicitly in detail, and which parts of this story which parts of this story are merely
hypothesis.
Well, it's stronger than a hypothesis. Huh. The entire story that Barry is telling, that Schrodinger told about the cat, is entailed by the physical equations which have been confirmed, at least for microscopic objects.
Barry,
Laura? I think we better finish the story.
Yeah. Let's get back to the cat in the box.
So remember this cat. Okay, and the cat is in a box with the electron. The electron is in a superposition of being blue and red. The cat then measures the color of this electron, and amazingly, quantum mechanics predicts that the cat goes into a superposition of being alive and dead. And the problem now for philosophers and physicists is understanding what in the world that could mean. As David was just saying, the theory which predicts that has been very, very well tested at the subatomic level.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever tested it with respect to cats. In the kind of example we're talking about, there are complicated problems with actually doing such an experiment.
All right, well, now let's stop for a moment and let me pose this to you, Barry Lower and David Alpert. I could charge you on the one hand with simply a bad analogy. Cats are not electrons. They may be composed of many electrons, but, you know, it really is a false comparison. On the other hand, we could look at what you two have been saying and draw from it what a commentary on the scientific method itself.
Well,
am I right?
Well, there's a sense in which, as a matter of fact, Barry isn't making an analogy at all when he tells this story about the cat.
If it's not an analogy, what is it?
As a matter of fact, this story about the cat is quite explicitly and exactly the way in which this theory, if it's true, predicts that an actual cat would behave under those circumstances.
Well, that led to the question of scientific method and scientific inquiry. Its reliability. Am I on the right track?
Well, yes. That, of course, and one of the important reactions to this story of Schrodinger's, one of the historically important reactions, was to say, well, apparently we are trusting the theory too far beyond the domain of phenomena which it was designed to explain mm-hmm. in the first place.
Now, does that bring us to what, the philosophical inquiry, or are we overlooking some steps here? Barry,
well,
Laura?
I think there are two kinds of responses that one might make. There is the response of someone who doesn't want to take the theory all that seriously, and there's the heroic, imaginative response.
Okay.
Some people look at this theory at this point and they say, as David was suggesting, well, maybe the theory just doesn't extend when we have many, many electrons.
That is a cat.
A cat. Maybe the theory in some way we don't yet understand becomes fails at that point. The problem is that no one has made a really good proposal, a proposal that's clear and explicit and that can be tested of exactly how the theory fails and what happens then. And of course, if in fact the theory did fail at that point, then the fundamental theory of the world wouldn't be quantum mechanics. It would be some successor theory, which no one has thought of yet. In any case, it's not the job of philosophers to construct such a new theory. The job of philosophers is to interpret the theory that's already in place. And I should emphasize that what quantum theory has shown, what it suggests at any rate, is that the states of things can be in ways that have been unforeseen, a new way, a way which no one had ever thought of before. A cat can be neither alive nor dead, And by that, we don't mean that he's sort of half dead. He's sort of tired out.
Right, nor both, nor neither.
Nor both, nor neither. Right. A cat is in this new kind of state, a superposition. And now the problem for really both philosophers and physicists is to find some way of giving meaning, some way of understanding that.
All right, let me propose something to you that may take you entirely far afield, too far afield. If it does, tell me so. Are we into what, the transcendental? Are we into the supernatural here? You make me think, again, by way of analogy, when Christians talk about the divinity of Christ, God and man, we're talking about these combinations that seem at one and the same time to contradict one another. And I'm not necessarily inviting you to talk theologically for me, but is that a way of thinking about the kind of thing that you're describing?
I guess, in a certain sense, and maybe this is, I think, what excites Mary and I about it, it's profoundly the opposite of that.
All right.
That is, what's going on here is that we are being forced to confront odd and metaphysically odd claims about the structure of the world by the structure, by the mathematical structure of what we now take to be our best scientific theory of how the world operates.
So you leave us with a word like uncertainty, and not necessarily thinking negatively when we use that kind of term. Barry?
Well, let's see. I'd like to make a point about the difference between theology
uh-huh.
and science here. Of course, there are paradoxes in theology as well, and a philosopher might try to understand what a theologian is saying. But we should be clear that quantum theory has experimentally testable consequences for the world,
uh-huh.
and these consequences have been tested over and over and over again.
We've got empirical elements at work.
And the theory is the most successful theory that anyone has ever thought up. Of course, theological speculations may be in some way successful or interesting or important as well, but in a very, very different way. Let me come in here quickly and just say, as a philosopher of science, one of the reasons that quantum theory is so interesting to philosophers of science is that it presents challenges to a philosopher of science for how to understand a scientific theory. There are two great traditions in the philosophy of science for understanding a scientific theory. Let me just give them labels. One's called instrumentalism and the other's called realism. An instrumentalist understanding of a theory says the theory is just an instrument. It's just used to make predictions, to see where dials on meters end up and when experiments are being performed.
Well, it has a kind of an arbitrary quality to it?
No, not that it's arbitrary.
We're not talking absolute and relative then?
No.
Okay.
No, it's just that the point of a theory is to predict the results of experiments mm-hmm. and nothing else. In particular, not to explain why things happen in the world, or not to describe what is really going on when experiments aren't being made. On the other hand, there's a realist tradition in science. The realist thinks that the point of science is to give a true story about the nature of reality, a reality that's independent of human observation
and
human
experiment. Story is the operative word there, kind of like a grand narration of things?
Yes, except under experimental control.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, in the history of quantum theory, the instrumentalist approach was, oversimplifying a bit, represented by the famous physicist Niels Bohr, mm-hmm. and the realist approach was represented by Albert Einstein, and the two struggled over the nature of quantum theory over a period of years, exactly here. Now, David and I are interested in giving a realist interpretation of quantum theory, and maybe it'd be a good idea if he describes such an interpretation.
How about this, David?
Well, there are a couple of attempts to construct a realist interpretation. We should mention by preface that it's probably more or less, it's once again an oversimplification, but it's probably more or less fair to say that the traditional approach on the part of both physicists and philosophers to these paradoxes, to these quantum mechanical paradoxes that we've been talking about, to the idea of superposition, is to what has been to despair altogether of telling oneself a story about what's going on there and adopting a fairly radically instrumentalist approach.
Are we talking about the difference between what? Random fragmentary observation and coherence? I don't want to present a sort of false polarity here.
But no, both of these attitudes aspire to make a coherent, systematic set of statements. They just differ on how broad a range of things they aspire to make statements about. The instrumentalist only wants to make claims about how his experiments are going to come out. What needles are going to be doing on the meters on his experimental devices. Mm-hmm. The realist wants to tell a story about how the meters came to be, how the needles came to be pointing in those directions.
Well, that
on
sounds
the meters.
To me like the
What's
original.
What's going on behind? This is very much the kind of original naive scientific aspiration.
Well, not scientists, but philosophers. That's what philosophers do. They tell us about what the gist of the whole design.
Sure,
Barry?
Of course. You know, the famous metaphor for that in the history of philosophy is Plato's cave.
Right.
And you know, Plato contrasted someone who just saw the shadows, the observations moving on the wall of the cave, with somebody who understood why the shadows move the way they move. Well, quantum theory has been taken by some people, those who favor an instrumentalist idea, mm-hmm. to show that we cannot, it's just in the nature of things that we cannot understand why the meters end up where they, why the pointers end up where they end up.
But you two as realists are seekers of meaning in this larger sense.
Yeah, I think it's right to say that. We've been interested in attempts to construct realistic interpretations of what's going on here, in particular of what's going on in superpositions. And there are two main approaches that we've been writing about lately. One of them is due to a long string of people, including Louis de Broglie, famous French physicist, David Bohm, an American physicist, and John Bell, another American physicist. That attempt is an attempt to think of a scheme whereby we would recover the ability to say about these electrons, which are apparently neither blue nor green, nor both nor neither, that they really are blue or green. That is an attempt to get around the arguments that had been presented to show that it's wrong to think of them as blue or wrong to think of them as green. And once again, maybe it's worth emphasizing at this point that these names, blue and green, are a little facetious. The electrons don't really have colors. We're just substituting simple terms for familiar properties.
Fair enough.
Now,
Barry?
We might mention that on that particular approach, the approach of Bohm and Bell, while one is able, they've shown how one's able to talk about the electrons really being blue or really being green, there's a great cost. And the cost of that approach is that it turns out that events that happen at one part of the universe can instantaneously affect events at some other far distant part of the universe.
Are you talking about causality in the sense of I'm responsible for what's going on?
Yeah,
the
very
other?
Much so.
Yeah, but it's a funny kind of causality,
uh-huh.
because while it's causality like that, it turns out that it's causality, which according to these theories, is beyond our ability or anyone's ability to control, so that it would be, for example, impossible to use this kind of causality to send a message, mm-hmm. let's say, from one end of the galaxy to the other instantaneously.
You're not talking about telepathy. You're talking about causality.
No, some people hearing about this immediately think that support has been given ESP and various things like that. That doesn't seem to be the case. But this theory, we should emphasize, literally is in conflict with what special relativity says about the nature of the world. In conflict with it on a realist interpretation of relativity, it turns out, though, that there's no conflict experimentally. Well, I've just told you about one realist interpretation of quantum theory and a realist interpretation of superposition. On that interpretation, it turns out that electrons and other particles always are in definite states, but the cost of that interpretation is this non-locality that we were just talking about, that something in one part of the galaxy can affect something else instantaneously.
Uh-huh.
Physicists would consider that very undesirable because, as we just mentioned, that conflicts with special relativity. There's another idea, in some ways a crazier sounding idea, that David and I have been working on, a way of preserving locality and also giving an interpretation of what a superposition is. It's a descendant of something called the Many Worlds account, and maybe I should let David describe that.
Okay, David, how about this?
Well, as Barry said, this is another attempt to construct a realist account of what's going on, an attempt not to succumb to instrumentalism, but also to avoid what is now known to be the necessary cost of non-locality, if one wants to say of these electrons that they really are blue or green in spite of appearances. The other option one has, which is an option that Barry and I, as he said, have been exploring lately, is to grant that, as a matter of fact, the electrons, as they are in the physical world, are neither blue nor green under these circumstances, but that for some reason, a reason which one wants to construct an explicit theory in order to explain, for some reason we suffer from the delusion that they are either blue or green. Okay.
No, wait. You're presenting me with the problem of where is the reality? In my mind, mm-hmm. in my eye, or in the thing
yes.
outside?
Yes. I think that's an appropriate way to characterize it.
All right.
One can, as a matter of fact, the mathematical structure of quantum mechanics affords the possibility of constructing a theory, one of whose consequences is that we are very radically and elaborately deluded about what the world really looks like.
I might break in to point out that the delusion here would be a kind of delusion of what's normally thought to be sanity.
Right.
So the ordinary way in which the world appears to us, yeah. that way, the ordinary way, the sane way, is on this account an illusion, a grand illusion.
Now it hardly needs to be said that that this theory, like the earlier one we talked about, involves a gigantic cost. As well. That is, the cost of adopting this theory is a sacrifice of the most basic tenets of our common sense about how we relate to the external world.
Well, on a recent edition of Soundings, I remember an English professor, he's not a philosopher or a physicist, but he has every right to say it, telling me that common sense itself is an ideology. It's just another approach to the way things are, so there's nothing wrong with describing it
well,
that way.
Well, it would be fair to say that it would have to be a doomed one if this theory were to be seriously adopted.
All right. Well, Barry Loher, let me give you the last word here. Common sense, whether we're including it or excluding it from the equation. What are the implications for philosophy when we talk about quantum mechanics?
Well, there are three kinds of implications which we would emphasize. One is, as we've been saying, the very idea of a superposition, the nature of a superposition, introduces into philosophy a new way of being. And that's something that philosophers need to think about and come to understand. A second point, which I don't think we've emphasized sufficiently yet, is that superpositions have a kind of non-local or holistic character. In fact, two particles distant in space can be elements of the same superposition, and that has consequences of the following sort. If something happens to one of those particles, instantaneously that can affect, on the realist understanding of superposition that we've been using, instantaneously that can affect the other particle. And finally, and this is where our contributions really are, we think that thinking realistically about superpositions, that is, giving a realist interpretation to superposition, inevitably has consequences for the nature of mind and the relationship to mind and the physical universe, and that's spelled out a bit in this the far-out many minds interpretation that we talked about.
Right. Let me stop you. A quick footnote here, Barry Loher. You bring to mind psychobabble. You know, I mean, you use the word holism. Mm-hmm. How do you philosophers do quantum mechanics respectively? Is that a legitimate question?
Well, sure, it's a legitimate question. I hope what we're doing is respectable. We, you know, have no problem publishing in respectable journals. But I think I'm sensitive to the kind of question you ask because, you know, there's been a certain amount of interest from the New Age science side of things in philosophy of quantum theory. And some of the ideas are so far out, they're apt to catch the imagination of people who are more interested in Eastern philosophy and yeah. California things than in physics. What I want to say is this, that in fact, there is a very respectable tradition in philosophy and philosophy of physics and in the foundations of physics in thinking about these kinds of problems. What we hope we're doing is contributing to a philosophical understanding of problems in quantum mechanics. If that should excite the imagination of people who are not professional philosophers, well, all the better. I think it's better for people to think about these problems, even if in some ways mistakenly so, or making connections with things that I wouldn't make connections with, than not to think about them at all.
David Albert holds a doctorate in theoretical physics and teaches in the Department of Philosophy at Columbia University. Barry Lohr is a professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Physics and Philosophy is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 459. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about French cinema during the early decades of the 20th century and about European realist fiction. My guests will be Richard Abel of Drake University and Lillian First of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The third week in July marks an anniversary for the birth of the atomic age. On July 16, 1945, the world's first atomic bomb was detonated at Trinity Site, 120 miles south of Albuquerque, New Mexico. In mid-July 1790, George Washington signed legislation designating the District of Columbia as the permanent capital of the United States. During the third week of July 1715, the Riot Act became part of British culture. According to 18th-century British law, the Riot Act prevented the unlawful assembly of 12 or more persons. Seneca Falls, New York, was the site of the first Women's Rights Convention, which took place during the third week in July 1848. Finally, the American writer Ernest Hemingway, the English novelist William Makepeace Thackeray, and the American mystery writer Earl Stanley Gardner have birthdays during the third week in July. Ernest Hemingway was born in 1899, William Makepeace Thackeray in 1811, and Earl Stanley Gardner in 1889. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Physics and Philosophy, this week on Soundings. Listen for David Albert of Columbia University and Barry Lohr of Rutgers University. According to David Albert and Barry Lohr, quantum mechanics invites a reconsideration of the most basic philosophical categories used to think about the world. Physics and Philosophy, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.